There's lots to fit into today's perspective. Later we'll hear about the final demise of the Divisive Clause 5 and a bill which aims to enhance consumer protection and enable more effective regulation of the pensions industry. But first, I attended the public evidence session held last Monday, which heard powerful testimony from Garth residents against the Moor Vannon wind farm.
I'm Georgina O'Sullivan. I'm a member of NOT4 IOM, that's No Offshore Turbines for the Isle of Man, and I'm a Garth resident. I mean, we've had so little opportunity to actually get our views or ask questions or be heard. So we've all worked very hard over the last 2 months to try and understand what's going on with this examination board. And, the examination team are sitting there and they've got a job and a mandate to do. But actually, a lot of what we were talking about today was directed at our government, because MEMA and our government bodies have put this in place. And it's the first one they've ever done. And frankly, we're a bit shocked as to how badly it's all working out in terms of the people knowing what's going on.
There did seem to be quite a lot of criticism, particularly of government. What is the concern there?
Well, I think it's the fact that this was a deal that was signed almost 11 years ago, November 2015, and then it went underground. Nobody knew about it. I think the terms at the time were talked about in the media by the developer. The government never really said anything. And then it emerged 9 years later, and suddenly was on fast superdrive. And suddenly, the public were faced with, here's what's happening, here's the consultation, we're going to go through to examination, and then it's going to be a decision. And of course, the whole suspicion around that was, well, maybe this has already been done. Maybe this is a done deal. And we've said, well, we've asked everybody and they've said, oh, no, it's not a done deal. We're going through the procedures. But the fact that we get so little information, that we can't talk to our political representatives, that we're coming up to an election, all of these things add up to being rather suspicious.
And your organisation now has a significant membership.
Well, we are closing in just over 6,500 signed on the petition. We've got 2,400 followers following us every day on Facebook. It's a very low-key sort of platform, but it's all that's been available. And the Isle of Man people have really, once they realized that they did have a voice and they could get information, they've been, that petition is growing up by 100 a day. So we know that probably within the 2 months time frame that we've set, we'll be at 10,000 people have signed that petition.
An awful lot of people who spoke kind of qualified what they were about to say by saying, actually, we are very passionate environmentalists. However, this is the wrong project at the wrong time. Does that pretty much summarise your thinking?
Yes, it does. I mean, I buy into the whole thing that we've all got to be more economical with our use of power. We've got to reduce, reuse, recycle, all of that. The problem with this deal is that it's massively out of scale for the island, and all of the energy is going to the UK. We see no evidence that the so-called SAP to the, or the SOP to the public, to say you might be getting green energy and renewables and energy security. We're not having any of that, unless we pay huge amounts of money to try and make that happen, and we don't see that happening. It's not in place. There's no energy agreement in place. Manx Utilities have really not even worked up the financials on it. So, there's a lot of disingenuous misinformation out there, and I think you probably heard that, a lot of people have been incensed by the fact that there's posters all over from Ørsted showing our beautiful island, and it's almost like a stab in the back. Here's our beautiful island, but we're not going to show you one pictures of it with the turbines in the water. We can't go that far, because that would be a step too far.
Are you confident in the process, and how confident are you that you're going to succeed in opposing this?
Well, I think we have to say, when we started, we knew nothing, and we thought we just have to do something. And as the time goes on, and as people sign up and contact me, and hundreds of inquiries a day, I'm sitting with our team, we're dealing with this full time, we're starting to feel the tide turn for sure. And will we succeed? I don't know. I hope that the examination team can look at all of this and hear the emotion and the passion from the Manx people, because that was coming out tonight. This will be devastating for many people. And I don't know what the outcome will be, Phil, but we're going to give it everything we can to try and stop it.
That was Moore Vannan campaigner Georgina O'Sullivan. Next, Garth Commissioners Jamie Smith and newly elected Chair Richard Henthorne. Richard speaks first.
You had a fairly impassioned contribution to make to the public meeting.
Yes, you have 5 minutes to put your point across. And to be honest, after hearing the previous people, I kind of changed what I was going to speak about, because I was quite angry, and it does make you angry. We feel that we've been pressurised into this as a small local authority. We are the ones who, you know, sort of began all this, getting it out in the public eye. We had 10 volumes of Orsted, deeply technical paperwork, each volume having hundreds and hundreds of pages in. And, you know, we weren't even originally allowed to have a copy of those 10 volumes. We were asked to go to Ramsey Library and read them. And so when we kicked up a fuss, they said, OK, you can have the copies, but it's going to cost you £1,000. This was the Cabinet Office. So we kicked up more of a fuss, and eventually we were allowed these 10 volumes, which sat in the middle of the Commissioner's table. And we were, five or seven of us at the time, just had to go through these documents. In 12 weeks, we had to read these technical, deeply technical documents. And to be honest, we've learned as much as we can. We feel we know more than most of the MHKs on the island. We've tried to talk to them, and most of them don't want to speak about it because they might preclude them from a cabinet position next time round. And those we have spoken to don't really know that much about it.
And how does that make you feel when you're basically confronted with MHKs who say they don't really know that much about it?
Deeply suspicious, unfortunately, because it's kind of been... it almost seems like it's kind of been hurried through in a bit of a hurry, and trying to keep it quiet as possible. It's deeply worrying for us, you know, that we're being cornered into this position, made to come and appear at meetings like this and have conversations, deeply technical conversations, and try to fight Garth's corner. And that's why I got angry, because they're selling Garth down the river for £57 million. And I asked one of our MHKs, why can't you make 3% of savings within government efficiencies, and that will give you £57 million a year? And the reply was, well, we'd have to get rid of doctors, and we'd have to get rid of nurses, we'd have to get rid of other people like that. And I said, well, can't you just make efficiencies in other ways? You know, there's a lot of people in a lot of departments, and you've taken on an awful lot of people since you've got into power, and that's where all the money's going. So that's the way to make the savings, not to industrialise the whole landscape of Garth, to get the gain. And how long is this £57 million going to last until it's all used up again in some department and we're back again? What do we do then? Sell Peel's coastline off then, and then we're up at the Point of Ayre and down at the south of the island, so the whole island surrounded with it, to support our income, because we keep paying out all the time. You know, that's why I'm angry about it. The Garth are fighting their corner, this massive company, and government seem to have just completely gone to ground and gone silent about it.
You have engaged with the public recently. Tell us a bit about that.
We initially had a meeting last September in the Institute to let people know about it. And when it was really just a very small subject, in fact, how Not for Isle of Man got involved, is we sent a little leaflet out around our residence, and Gina, who's now running the Not for Isle of Man group, she came to us and said, I didn't know anything about this. So we consulted with people, we told them what was proposed, we told them what Orsted were proposing and what government were going to get for it and all this kind of thing. And you know, resoundingly, everybody in that meeting, and I do appreciate that only people who are object to things generally tend to turn up at meetings, Everybody was really resoundingly against it. And so we started to look into it a lot more. We started to look into the information. We read all this documentation. And we came to the point just a few weeks ago that we should have another meeting and update the Garth residents about what is going on and what is proposed. And all the things that we found out about this proposal, this non-disclosure of this contract that was signed in 2015, we've asked for freedom of information, it's been refused twice. Well, what is in that document? Is there something in that document saying that if they don't say yes to Orsted, then we're going to get millions of pounds of financial penalties? So we've updated people, we've had this meeting, we had over 200, maybe even more people came in, filled in a form. We're now disseminating that information and trying to send it back, take it back to MEMA, and they've said tonight that they will accept views from those from those little surveys. But what I'd just say to the Manx public is that even if we persuade our two MHKs in the Garth area that to be against this, it's only two people in a room of 24. We need at least 12 to 14 to 15 MHKs to be firmly against this, so that when it comes to the decision making in Tynwald next year or whatever, that it is turned down, because it'll fundamentally change not only Garth but the island eventually, because we'll become this. Once they put one in, it'll become an industrialised thing. It'll be all around us. We've seen a little plan with the paper on the paperwork with these things all around the island. We've seen that.
Talking to Jamie Smith, also Garth Commissioner.
I'd just like to highlight the emotion we've seen tonight. You've heard it probably in Richard's voice, and just people were just speaking from the heart. These are just people who've, you know, they're volunteers and they're people spending their own time, and you just heard them quoting from the Manx National Anthem, Gem of God's Earth, talking about that feeling of what it's like coming home when you on the plane, when you're looking out for that first sign of the Isle of Man, or you're on the ferry and you're looking to see it. And it really came through tonight, that emotion that people feel. They feel frustrated, they feel angry, they feel the government's let them down somewhere, that, you know, that this is, they don't know whether it's a done deal. There's no power agreement, we know that. There's no obligation from Orsted to provide us any electricity, let alone it at a cheap value. And it's just come through. We're feeling it. I know one of the speakers today, I won't name which one, has said to me that she's feeling ill. Just that, you know, she's worried it's having an effect on her health. We in Garth Commissioners, we're small little parish commissioners, really. We've got one in the office, we've got one full-time employee, two part-timers, and we're still getting dog mess that we have to mess with and planning applications. Our member of staff, Martin Roll, I want to name him, he wasn't here tonight, but he got a round of applause when someone mentioned him. And honestly, the emotion and anger that we heard tonight was absolutely took my, you know, breath away.
That was Garth Commissioners Jamie Smith and Richard Henthorne. One MHK who has spoken out against Moor Vannan is Garth MHK Andrew Smith. You have been one of the MHKs who has actually made their views known about the Orsted development.
Yeah, yes, I did. And that was late last year when we had a public meeting in the Laxey Working Men's Institute. And I think it was important because looking at the, right at the outset, before we even had this examination board, right at the outset, when you looked at the implications and the gravity of the whole scheme, then I think it was totally out with what any rational Garth resident at least would have wished for. It just beggars belief, I believe. So I said right at the outset, and I know that and there's been talk since about MHKs can't say this, can't say that, but I believe that if you've been elected to represent the people and such a major issue as this crops up in your constituency, then you need to speak on behalf of the people. And because the people are so vehemently against it, as I am, then why not? I can speak out, and I'm not holding fire on that.
And what is your understanding of the advice that the Attorney General gave to MHKs?
Well, obviously, he gave advice in that if you spoke out, then you could be conflicted at a future date. But I'm not interested in future. I mean, today is important. Tomorrow will look after itself. And I think you've got to, you know, you just have to say, well, I mean, that opinion could change in the future. We're interested in today and what's happening currently to ensure that we get the right outcome for the island and its people. And I'm not against green policies. I'm not, but I think that we need to carefully consider how we're looking to embrace wind energy, wave energy, whatever it may be, because it's critical that we've got a beautiful island with coastal sea views. I mean, even you know what they did in Cornwall, because of the Jurassic coast, they just pushed it back. They said, no, this is of extreme beauty and of scenic value. And we've got the same, and we've just created Charlie's View on behalf of Sir Charles Carouche, the longest serving, you know, politician and president of Tymwald. So hang on a minute, you know, what are we trying to do? That's a total, well, reverses what we're looking to do regarding this beauty of our island. So I say it just beggars belief as far as I'm concerned. So I'll continue to push against it. Yes, I can't be, and one or two people have challenged me on that you're not at the evidence sessions. But in fairness, as you will know, in Treasury, it's not a part-time job. And currently, with the legislation that Treasury has to get through before the end of this administration, which has got delayed as a consequence of other legislation that's, for whatever reason, has taken precedence, we were having to work flat out to do that. So I'm sorry that I may not be physically at the examining board's meetings, but I've got people there, they know my views, they're feeding back to me, and I am working frantically behind the scenes to support the lobby group and anybody else that is against this wind farm proposal.
Do you think as politicians, just because I was thinking about this myself during the evidence session, because some of my words were being used because I moved the Marine Infrastructure Management Bill, which later became the Act, and what I was thinking when I moved that, compared with what I was thinking when I was sat through that evidence stage, was quite different. And you know, there are certain things that you are thinking about as politicians, which would be what's in the best interest of the Isle of Man, what's going to help fill your gaps in public finances, and also what's going to help us address our part, at least, of the whole mitigation against climate change, all those sorts of things you think about. But perhaps we're not that good when the high level policy is being considered, about thinking what are the public going to think about.
Well, this is often the case, and that's why when it's critical when you're drafting legislation that you've you're doing it on the day and for the time that you know when you're actually constructing it and putting it through the various branches, but then you've also got to consider how it may affect the future. And I think it's important that you get that balance in legislation when you look at, well, hang on a minute, this is right for today, but how may that impact if things change? Yes, you can amend legislation, we know all that, we know all about that, but I think if you get the basics right, then you've at least got a chance of people know how and when that legislation can be rightly used.
Are the people who are speaking up, and you know, I'm not criticising them for doing that, are they truly representative of the all the voices in your constituency, Garth, or is it more nuanced than that, do you think? Maybe there are more people who actually do support the wind farm but aren't so keen to raise their heads above the parapet?
Well, from my experience, the meeting that I attended right at the outset when I was outspoken about it, there was only one other member of the public there that was for it, so I think that was overwhelming. I think the signatures, of which now six to six and a half thousand that we've got now, and they have been properly audited, so there's nobody can, you know, kind of vote twice, and they've had an interrogation audit, so they're all against, they can't be wrong. So obviously you may get those now that feel that they are for it, but they may be a bit reticent in coming forward because there are so many people against it. That's a possibility. But in fairness, the ones that are against it have got some very, very strong arguments. And there are one or two that have got, that are principal stakeholders, just as I am, because obviously I did put evidence, written evidence in, so I am a principal stakeholder in this examination process. And they have been very, very diligent and articulate in their arguments against it. So I just think, from what I'm hearing, unfortunately, that obviously we've got a situation where as government or civil servants that are trying to they're trying to challenge various things, but they're up against lawyers and barristers on the opposite side. So I mean, it's I think there's a bit of an imbalance there, but obviously that seems to be how the examining board is going at the moment. But what I do understand is that they seem to be quite strict in the way that they run it, and I thought at first it may be because some of the examining from doing background research into the examination board members that they were from various elements that had already promoted wind farms. I thought that there may be some bias there, but I'm understanding now that it's possibly not. That's not the case, and they are being more rigorous in their questioning. So I'm very happy about that.
Yes, and certainly the session that I attended, they were very, they appeared in a way to be balanced and yeah, being fair. What was clear from the evidence session was, I think almost everyone that gave evidence recognised the need to address climate change. Many of them said, I'm not a climate denier, climate change denier, but the scale of this solution is just too big for what we need. And actually, there doesn't seem to be that much evidence that we're going to get this electricity anyway.
No, it's not. Now, if it was a wind farm and we actually had another internet cable coming and landing, one thing or another, and they say, well, that might happen down the road, but we're not interested down the road. We're interested in what's happening now. Then you could say, well, okay, let's take a different, slightly relaxed view about that. But it's not. We're not getting anything. All we're getting is the seabed rights, and I think it's not about that necessarily. I think it's just, I don't think it's about the net gain, because we're not getting the net gain. I think it's just about the financials, and that's not, I don't think that's right. And for me to say that I'm not interested in climate change is obviously totally untrue, because obviously I've been through all the flooding in Laxey, in fairness, which people can argue that was as a consequence of certain elements of climate change. So the amount of time and effort that I've had to put into the flooding issues in Garth generally, not just Laxey Centre, but also in Mackledon, other places that have got this fast runoff of water that then hits the constricted gullies and the streams and things. So we're working on that. So yeah, I definitely recognise there is, but I think again there's a balance to it, and sometimes I think that balance is skewed, where everyone jumps on this, and even the ones that we're following have pushed back. From saying, well, no, diesel cars out by 2030, then it's 2035, the next it's, so other people recognise that, yes, it's important, but you've got to do it in a staged and balanced way. And I think we shouldn't be in the vanguard with all this and follow just like sheep led to the slaughter. We should actually stand up for ourselves and what is best for the Isle of Man.
As a Treasury man, though, I guess £2 billion would be a particularly helpful addition.
Obviously it would be very helpful, but you don't just take money at any consequence. That's not the name of the idea or the name of the game. So yes, Treasury is looking for income, and we need income, because otherwise people can't enjoy the various things that our income provides. Health, education, security, police, etc., etc. So the thing is that we've got to be balancing that. Just because there's somebody dangling a £2 billion carrot doesn't mean that we've got to jump and take it, because if it's not right for the island and its people.
That was Andrew Smith, MHK. In a shift of direction now, we hear from leading Douglas councillor Devon Watson, who opposed the inclusion of Clause 5, which would have controversially given powers to central government to impose duties on local authorities.
You will have heard that Clause 5 was removed by the Keys, and of course the Legislative Council sitting just passed. Clause 5 had its last gasp and was extinguished completely by the Legislative Council.
Yeah, no, it's really excited. I think this is one of the ways that democracy ought to work, right? And the fact that you do have a well-organized constituency of locally elected democratic bodies who are fighting to sort of ensure that they're able to maintain some sort of autonomy from Tynwald. The reason why local authorities existed in the first place was to provide that democratic accountability. Because for a very long time, I'm not sure if this is a widely known fact about the history of the Isle of Man, but local authorities were established by local communities to deal with local problems. For example, the intense slum problems in Douglas in the 1850s, 1860s. And they were democratically elected while Tynwald was not. And they were there to provide this democratic sort of counterbalance. And in some ways, the conflicts between these two entities are the thing that made Tynwald democratic by forcing them to adopt models of universal suffrage eventually. So I think it's one of those where there's always going to be conflict between local authorities and national government. You can see the fact that our public transport systems, our sewer systems, our street lighting systems, and now today the most innovative housing systems all come from local authorities and are later eventually adopted. So it's the sort of tide of things to come to some extent.
What the former minister would say, though, is that actually government needed this Clause 5 big stick to sort of beat the less compliant local authorities with. Is that fair?
I think that there is maybe, to some extent, a way that we communicate concerns in a way that sort of brings people along with us. I've got massive respect for the minister, but on this path, perhaps I disagree slightly. That's my most diplomatic, that's the most politician-y thing you're going to hear from me. But, I mean, I think that, yes, there are some governance issues in some local authorities. Yes, democracy in local authorities is necessarily a lot more messy. Yes, there are members who maybe do things that they shouldn't do, and clerks fighting with members and all of that sort of stuff. But I do think that a sort of chaotic, rambunctious democracy is not necessarily always a bad thing. And I think that there is a role for government to step in the event that there is a severe governance issue. And I think that those parts of the governance parts of the local government bill were unanimously supported by the local authorities. I think the thing that we dislike is the ability of Tynwald or the government to dictate that local authorities should provide certain types of service, regardless of the wishes of their constituents, paid for by those constituents for services that they may not want or may not be sort of suitable for the area. For example, if you're in a parish with 500 people, providing a full library might not make as much sense as if you were in a town of 27,000, 28,000, right? So it was that concern about DOI power overreach was the motivation for pushing back, not because people don't want good governance.
So then, let's look for the positives from this whole exercise. I mean, it is fair to say that many local authorities were deeply upset about the whole way in which this was handled. But one thing that did happen was an awful lot, not quite the complete number of local authorities, but a significant majority got together and worked together. Is that something that's going to continue, do you think?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's one of the things that Douglas has now sort of changed its internal constitution to mandate that the leader of council should always be a part of the municipal association. We have these very strict sort of internal structures about how we participate now, and we're really dedicated to sort of working toward making this an organization that is a lot more disciplined and a lot more focused on sort of delivering for people. I think it's absolutely excellent. But I think what we've noticed there is that the municipal association is now an organization that focuses, that is working to sort of provide all island benefits. So pushed really heavily on making sure that dilapidated and derelict properties now pay rates. Dereliction is a problem, and empty properties are a problem all over the island. And this is something the municipal association has been on the forefront of, because this is something we've been really passionate about. Getting pension reform at local authority level to make the pensions sustainable into the long term is one of the things that the municipal association has been doing. And, consulting on the waste strategy.
Just on that pension reform, I mean, this is costing local authorities quite significant amounts, isn't it? And it's the last bit of public sector pension that hasn't been reformed. What is the holdup with that?
Drafting resources within the DOI. So I think that there is a problem, and I do sympathise with the DOI, but if the DOI is in a place where they have limited legislative resources, departments have cut themselves down to the bone in order to sort of meet budgetary targets, they don't have the ability to deal with some of these other measures. And the thing is, though, if this would long-term save local authorities about £1 million a year, but it would cost the DOI $100,000, $200,000 a year to do that drafting work. I don't know the figures. Don't quote me on that, right? I don't know how much drafting work is. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a legal expert. But essentially, there's a management agent problem there in which the person who receives a benefit isn't the one who pays for the benefit. So I think there needs to be a better way of us communicating our costs through to the DOI and making sure it's not just simply a hierarchical relationship where we wait for things to be done, but we find ways of either A, contributing, or B, having government that's responsive to the needs of local authorities and ratepayers, because everybody's a ratepayer and everybody's a taxpayer. The division between local authorities and national government is silly because the average person on the street doesn't care whether something is a local authority. They don't care whether it's national government. They just want to see services delivered.
And, I mean, on that, couldn't the local authorities club together and hire in their own legislative drafter?
I mean, it's one of the things that I think that there's been a lot of keenness of, and this is a sort of thing that we've been really keen to sort of enter into discussions over about that. But I think it's just where there is, I think that DOI just has very limited resources in order to progress that sort of pension reform work. It's something that we're really keen on. It's something that we're budgeting on. It's something that we absolutely need to, because at the same time, people face this really immense cost of living pressure. And yes, workers need to be taken care of, and we're going to continue to take care of them. But the only way you can take care of workers is if a pension is sustainable over the long term. And it has to be affordable for ratepayers. And I think we're trying to balance that fairness with also providing people affordable services.
You touched there briefly on housing. I mean, certainly in the south of the island, we have, I think, 5 different housing authorities, which, bearing in mind the number of people who live there, seems a little excessive. The department is pursuing yet another idea for housing, which was the idea of a... what was it?
Housing agency.
Housing agency, that's right. Douglas is as big as most of the rest of the island put together when it comes to its housing stock, possibly if you take Onchan out. Again, in the east, you've got Braddon, you've got Douglas, and you've got Onchan, all of which are housing authorities. And it's entirely possible that someone living close to the border of all three could be getting a bit confused as to where they need to go. Why can't we just all sort of work together and find a solution to this which makes it a lot easier for the end user?
Yeah, 100%, because I mean, I think at the same time is that if you're struggling with housing, it doesn't really matter where you live as long as you really get housed. I think that there's also a big difference in terms of ambitions between local authorities and ambitions between government in terms of housing. So what you'll notice is over the past few years is the pace of housing building has been, particularly social housing, has been painfully slow. So Douglas has built a little over 100 new social housing units, central government on net about 10. And what we would like to do is we'd like to build hundreds more. And at the end of this month, we're probably going to be submitting plans to build hundreds more. And hopefully government will give us tens of millions of pounds, will allow us to take that out in our own loans against our own stock to sort of do that. But I think that there's a difference in ambition. And some local authorities, like Onchan, struggle because they just don't have a lot of spare capacity and land. Other local authorities have very little capital. So what you notice there is that there is this prime opportunity for local authorities to cooperate with each other a lot more deeply than they currently do. What we found, though, is that we cooperate with other local authorities really, really well on housing. So, for example, when Braddon put up their new flats, they had some additional sort of capacity. So some of the people who are most desperate a few years back from Douglas ended up sort of going into some of those flats, which was really, really good. And like endless praise to Braddon for their work on that one. But there probably does need to be more coherent joined up. This is a housing crisis, and there hasn't been any sort of awareness from our elected representatives to actually treat it as a crisis. We've had forums and bodies and boards and committees, but no actual housing, right? I mean, if every word was a house, we'd be fine. But that's just not been the case.
Douglas councillor Devon Watson there. Finally, Gary Cluett, MLC, who tried to amend Clause 5 and was generally content to see it go. You had a contribution in the debate over the local government amendment bill. You were a little, what would you say, mildly irritated perhaps by some of the comments in the House of Keys about how Legislative Council had scrutinised that bill.
Yeah, I suppose that's one way of characterising it. We were faced with somewhat of a, I won't say an impossible situation, but a very challenging situation. So, for example, when the bill first came to us, the controversy with the local authorities had already started, clearly, as soon as it was introduced and passed in Keys. And, you know, I looked at it and it's like, well, my first reaction was, well, just amend it out of there, remove Clause 5. And that I couldn't do that. I'm on the record at least on three separate occasions. It was during the evidence session and I think during principles and clauses of the bill where, whether I liked it or not, for me, proposing or voting to remove Clause 5 in the face of overwhelming key support just seemed somewhat irresponsible. And I can just imagine the response from Keys if we had done that. You know, we would be seen to be clearly overriding the will of Keys. And I do respect, you know, their primacy in these matters. So, what's the next best thing? Well, you know, we do have this mechanism in LegCo where we can hold evidence sessions. And given that the bill came about as an amendment, so it was never consulted on, and the level of outrage that it provoked amongst local authorities, we decided we should have an evidence stage. And, you know, we invited all of the local authorities. I think some of the disquiet in Keys, I think it was mentioned by at least two members, was that the minister and Mr. Hooper were given leave to attend the evidence session, whereas nobody else could, because the challenge is that Keys and LegCo sit on the same day, on a Tuesday. But it happened. We felt it was very important to get the two prime movers behind that amendment in the same room with the local authorities to at least have an exchange of ideas, which we did. And I think it worked reasonably well. It certainly gave us pause for, you know, more further consideration. We did listen to Keys. I read every single word of all of the Hansards of the Keys debates. I took note of, you know, Mr. Thomas's concerns and comments and various other members. And what we decided, and I think, you know, I decided, and I think several other members had decided, was that we just didn't feel that we could overturn Clause 5 because of the support that it had gotten Keys. What's the next best thing? Well, how can we amend it? How can we ameliorate some of the concerns that were expressed, and legitimate concerns? I mean, as I said today, I think a lot of this was a storm in the teacup because few seem to have paid attention to the words of the Attorney General during the clauses stage in LegCo, where he was asked for a legal advice, and his opinion was that, you know, that no, the Department of Infrastructure could not impose duties upon local authorities that they were not originally statutorily obliged to provide. So I think an awful lot of this was...
Was it statutorily obliged to provide or statutorily able to provide?
I can't remember. I paraphrased it. But essentially, you couldn't just conjure up new things. They couldn't, for example, my understanding, one of the examples was that suddenly require that local authorities do something with streetlights or intersections or things that are normally DOI responsibilities. That is a somewhat complex area, but I think the problem was that nobody really understood the situation, and I suspect on all sides. We're not all lawyers, and we don't understand some of the detailed technicalities and things in some of these areas. But the point was, we came up with what we thought were workable things. I think the thing that where we got the initial pushback on the LegCo amendments was primarily around Clause 5, and it was to fundamentally about the post-legislative scrutiny, basically the sunset clause that after, I think it was three or four years, I can't remember what we settled on, that it would go back and would be reviewed. And the previous minister was unhappy with that because it, for some reason, and again, I'm not a lawyer. I relied on the drafting of the Attorney General's chambers on that clause in terms of how we would do that post review. And for some reason, it turned out, at least we were told, it was unworkable.
The Attorney General's chambers didn't tell you it was unworkable, presumably. This was Keyes.
It was the minister. And I think it was because essentially the review would have been commissioned by the Council of Ministers. And I think there was some technical issue around that. And again, it is what it is. The upshot of it is where we are today. I have not, I had no and still have no real passionate feelings about whether we should have had Clause 5 or not. It was immaterial. It was a case. It was there. We had to deal with it. We didn't feel like we could. At least I didn't feel like I could just, go in and remove it.
So even with all these caveats that you've put on, you were, Legislative Council was accused of straying into policy areas which should be reserved for the Keys. I mean, how, bearing in mind what you've just said, how could they have perceived that you were doing that?
I don't really understand that comment. This wasn't about policy. This was about, we held an evidence session, we talked to both sides, we came up with what we thought was a workable, mid-ground. That, I'd spoken to a number of local authorities about that, and they seem, I won't say happy, but certainly more content with that as what the original Clause 5 was. My view is we did exactly what we were supposed to do in Legislative Council. We scrutinised the legislation, we held the evidence session, we listened to both sides, we came up with an alternative that we felt was reasonable. There are other amendments. We made a few other amendments besides specifically to Clause 5, and they were all accepted by Keyes and will now be part of the bill. The main thing, frankly, is that this bill has been in gestation for many years across several administrations. There were very important things that the bill needed to put in place, and with or without Clause 5, I think today at least it can go for royal assent, and the bits that really, really do matter will hopefully become law very soon.
and on the subject of things becoming law very soon, there's another piece of legislation that your name was associated with, and that was in relation to pensions. Tell us, what was the bill and what was it about?
It's the Retirement Benefits Scheme bill. It's a modernisation of our retirement plans. The last update to the Retirement Act was done in 2000. It was over 25 years ago, which at that time was considered fit for purpose. But the world has changed. Financial regulations have been significantly strengthened across the board. And when you looked at the current act, there are many loopholes. There are deficits in the legislation to do with the way pension providers are governed. One of the things we did do under the existing act, most infractions carry criminal penalties, and so a good portion of this bill is to go to a more proportionate regime where there are other mechanisms in place that we're using across all the other financial services regulators, the Gambling Supervision Act, where there's more there's more ability to impose administrative sanctions and restrictions in that, rather than going to the criminal route. Primarily, but one of the concerns is forcing everything through the courts is just jam. The courts already got a huge backlog, very, very expensive process. And in some cases, they're sort of fairly minor regulatory or administrative oversights and things like that really shouldn't be in the courts. So that's part of it. The other thing is more regulation around. So essentially, in the future, with this, when this bill becomes an act, what it will do is it will require that every pension provider will have at least one trustee and there's basically two people that associate it with that. That must be registered with the Financial Services Authority, which they don't have to be today. There is very, very little regulation over that part of the industry right now in comparative terms. So it's really bringing and modernizing the framework around pensions, which will provide a lot more comfort and safety for people's whose benefits, retirement benefits, they've worked their entire lives for, are tied up with these pension funds. And if they fail to, adequately keep themselves capitalized, if they fail to do all sorts of things that are important for the fiscal soundness of a pension fund, they will now be regulated, and hopefully we won't be seeing more cases down the road of pension funds going under. And mainly because there will be now statutory requirements for the pension funds to do greater reporting and to provide detailed, if they run into financial difficulties, what their plan is to emerge from those and to address those, rather than just try and keep it quiet until everything goes totally pear-shaped. So.
Government has a habit of introducing what you might call belt and braces and bells and knobs and all the rest of it, types of regulation. It's regularly criticised for regulation being too onerous cumbersome in nature, making it quite difficult for all sides to operate. I mean, what guarantees have we that's not going to happen in this case?
Personally, in my own businesses, I rail at some of the regulations and things that we have to. But I acknowledge the fact that much regulation in the financial space today is not of our own making. We don't have a lot of choice in the matter. The international standards, regulations, and that determine what we should and shouldn't do in many cases. Again, in this case, it will be new. I believe we've consulted. The consultations have taken place with the industry on the island. I think they're largely sanguine with what is being proposed, which is nothing more than bringing it in line with other jurisdictions. I mean, our retirement benefits, retirement plans, and things will now finally be more in line with what has existed in the United Kingdom, Jersey and Guernsey for many, for probably two decades. So it's a change on the Isle of Man, but it's not something that is unexpected or novel in any way. I mean, we are just like on the, I recently brought through the Gambling Supervision Bill. Again, we are playing catch up in this area. And it's not, as I say, it's not that we, in some of these cases, that we willingly want to impose. In fact, I think there's a fairly conscious effort that when we do introduce this new legislation along these lines, that it is tempered in a way that isn't as least onerous as possible. I mean, that certainly is a consideration. I'm certainly aware of the burden that it imposes on business, which is a cost which then gets passed on to everything. I mean, there are costs associated with all regulation, and of course all those costs do get passed on.
That was MLC Gary Cluett. So what do you think? There was no doubting the passion of campaigners against the Moore Vannon wind farm, but is it really going to look as bad as they think? Was the right decision taken to drop Clause 5? Will local authorities actually work together to deliver real change? I'm Phil Gawne, Gunnar Myerson Geisterfrom. Thanks for listening.